Well, however unfamiliar you may be with the book of Deuteronomy, there's one passage at least with which you may well have some acquaintance. We read part of that passage this morning. It's in chapter 5. It's the Ten Commandments. And as we arrive then at this famous landmark within the book of Deuteronomy, I think it might be useful just to make three very general remarks. First general remark then. Moses cannot help reiterating here the priority of grace. Moses cannot help reiterating here the priority of grace. By the term priority of grace, I mean very simply that grace comes first. God's undeserved and inexplicable kindness comes before our obedience. That principle we've seen shapes the whole structure of this book, so that Moses doesn't begin to touch upon ethics until we get to chapter 4. Before that, there are almost three whole chapters devoted to history. History which is dominated by one single theme, God's abundant grace toward Israel. And it's only then, once Moses has set that in place, it's only once he has laid that foundation of God's grace toward Israel, that he's prepared then to enter onto the subject of ethics. This principle of God's grace coming before our obedience shapes the whole structure of this book. But what I'm saying now is this, that even when we come to the law section of Deuteronomy, even there, we still find Moses using every opportunity to stress this principle that grace comes before obedience. I think that's the point of that paragraph in chapter 4, verses 41 to 43, this apparently random reference to cities of refuge. Now, I don't think that we're being invited here to reflect upon this fascinating legal provision whereby anyone guilty of manslaughter, anyone who had unintentionally caused the death of another person, could find asylum and could escape the clutches of the dead person's relatives. I don't think we're being invited here to reflect upon that provision, to subject it to scrutiny and bring it to bear upon our own modern justice systems and that kind of thing. We'll get that opportunity later on in chapter 19 when Moses deals with it at much greater length. Here, I think, Moses is simply emphasizing that the Israelites are already enjoying the first fruits of God's promised land. They haven't crossed the Jordan yet, but already in God's goodness, they are enjoying the former territories of King Sihon and King Og. And they're enjoying those territories to such a full and concrete extent that cities only recently populated by pagans are now being incorporated into the nitty-gritty of Israel's legal system. It's a paragraph about grace. As I think is the next paragraph, verses 44 to 49 of Deuteronomy 4. Here again, I think, Moses is simply ramming home to the Israelites, look, God has already given you so much land. You haven't crossed the Jordan yet, but God has already given you a whole load of land. Its dimensions are detailed, aren't they, in verses 48 and 49. And notice, by the way, the extraordinary perspective that comes across in verses 45 and 46. These are the stipulations, decrees and laws Moses gave them when they came out of Egypt and were in the valley near Beth Peor, east of the Jordan, in the land of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon and was defeated by Moses and the Israelites as they came out of Egypt. Now, do you notice how Israel's history is being contracted there, isn't it? It gives the impression that the victory over King Sihon just came immediately after the exodus from Egypt. And there was no complication, no interruption in between those two events. Now we know, of course, there were 40 years in between those two events. there was a whole generation wiped out in between those two events. There was a divine chastisement of epic proportions in between those two events. And yet all of that is omitted here. Now, who could possibly have omitted that? Would any Israelite have omitted that in describing these events? Surely the scars of shame and regret over that 40-year period were too deep and too real within the Israelite psyche to possibly omit that in these verses here. Who would have omitted it? Well, is it not the case that this is God's perspective that we're getting here in verses 45 and 46? The same God we encounter in Luke 15. That God who welcomes home the prodigal and never even mentions that shameful episode of his in the far country. This is the God whom we encounter in 1 Corinthians 13, who alone can fully meet those requirements. Love keeps no record of wrongs. We're being confronted here by the sin-forgetting, sin-erasing, sin-obliterating grace of God. And then when we go on to the first few verses of chapter 5, God's grace is again the dominant theme, particularly when you go to verse 4 and that description there of Sinai. The Lord spoke to you face to face out of the fire on the mountain. Now, God's face in the Bible signifies his favorable disposition, his friendly mindedness, his goodwill, his acceptance, in a word. The key text is Numbers chapter 6, verses 24 to 26. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face towards you and give you peace. And Moses is reminding the Israelites here that despite their inherent unworthiness, despite the divine hostility which they really deserve, God has shone his face, his unclouded, shining face upon them. He has turned his smiling, beaming face upon them. And then you'll notice that even when Moses actually begins to articulate the Ten Commandments, even there he still can't drop this theme, can he, of God's grace. Even as he's actually beginning to utter them. Verse 6. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. That, of course, was the most basic manifestation of God's grace toward Israel. Yes, he had given them the lands of King Sihon and King Og. Yes, he had erased from his memory that 40-year wilderness period in their history. Yes, he had turned his shining face toward them. But all of those manifestations of his grace had underlying them this most fundamental manifestation of his grace. He had liberated them from Egypt. He had loosed their chains. He had relieved their misery. He had overturned their plight. And so it's that form of grace, that redemptive grace, that Moses is revisiting here in verse 6. And so you see what I'm saying then, that here we are now, and we're no longer in the first three chapters of Deuteronomy, which might more naturally be labelled the grace section of the book. No, now we're in chapters 4 and 5. Now we're in the law section of Deuteronomy. And yet even here, Moses just cannot help reiterating the priority of grace. And the reason he can't help reiterating it is because it's so vitally, vitally important. And it's essential that we have grasped this principle this morning. If you're not a Christian this morning, you need to grasp this principle. Because it means, you see, that God's message for you this morning, God's call to you this morning, isn't go and clean up your life. It isn't go and be a better person. It isn't go and keep the Ten Commandments. That isn't God's call to you this morning. Because God knows very well that you can't do those things. You're impotent. You're powerless. Sin exercises far too strong a grip upon you. No, God's message to you this morning is this. I have sent my Son as a Savior He has died at Calvary to liberate sinners from the bondage of sin. Receive him. Receive the salvation that comes through him as a free gift, no strings attached. And then, having done that, you will be in a position to live a different kind of life. And if you are a Christian this morning, you too need to grasp this principle, the priority of grace. Because it means that you don't keep God's commandments in order to earn something from him. Never ever do you do it for that reason. You're never ever, never at any point in your life now, having to contribute something to your own salvation. You don't go to bed at night having to review that day you've just lived, asking the question, have I done enough to satisfy God's demands? Because God has done it all. God has done everything that's required in his grace at Calvary's cross. And therefore you keep his commands now without fear, without anxiety, without paranoia. There's a different atmosphere to the whole thing. You keep his commands joyfully and enthusiastically and happily because your salvation doesn't depend upon them. You keep them simply because it's the appropriate response, the way of showing your gratitude for everything God has previously done for you. It's vitally important this morning that we're all clear on this principle, that God's grace always comes first before our responding obedience. Second general remark. The Ten Commandments aren't an arbitrary response to God's grace. The Ten Commandments aren't an arbitrary response to God's grace. Let's look again at verse 6 of chapter 5. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. Now let's ask the question, what was involved in this slavery, which was Israel's fate in the land of Egypt? What forms did that slavery assume? Well, for one thing, they were subjected to ridiculously excessive labor demands. They were forced to be construction workers, and their construction work had to keep pace with all Pharaoh's empire-building ambitions. And they were made to work relentlessly, therefore. And they were given the most unreasonable performance targets that they had to meet. They were subjected to ridiculous labor demands, and that was one form then that their slavery assumed. Then again, they were subjected to a horrific program of genocide. Do you remember that? Remember how all their male babies had to be drowned in the River Nile in order to keep Israelite population growth under control? That was another form then that their slavery assumed. Then again, they were subjected to a culture of idols. Some of you will have been to a funeral perhaps of an unchristian friend or relative, and you've gone to that funeral and you're grieving because of the death of this person that you're close to. And in that funeral then, in your grief, you've searched for something solid, which you can cling on to in your mourning and in your sadness. And yet, there's been absolutely nothing in that funeral of that nature. I had this a couple of years ago, going to the funeral of my cousin's wife, a woman in her early 40s, two youngish children. And there we were, staring in the face the tragedy of this death, and all we were given to cling on to was the mindless lyrics of that song, Lord of the Dance. And it was just, there was something oppressive about it. In that very moment when you most need the truth, when you most need the Saviour, when you most need the gospel to be applied, in that very moment there's just an absence of those things. And think of the Israelites. And there they were, day after day, working on those building sites. Imagine them going home each evening after a long, arduous day, and they're in turmoil, they're in distress, their thoughts and emotions are all over the place. And on street corner after street corner in Egypt, they have to walk past idol after idol after idol, this one in the shape of an eagle, this one in the shape of a woman, this one in the shape of a fish. What possible comfort could they offer them? What possible help could they extend to these suffering Israelites in their distress? It must have been an oppressive reality daily to be surrounded by these dumb, grinning idols when their lives were so terribly difficult. And that was another form then that their slavery assumed. And so here were three forms, there are many others, three forms which their slavery assumed there in the land of Egypt. But we're being told in verse 6 then that God had liberated them from their slavery. And how then were they to respond to God's liberating grace? Well, for one thing, they weren't to allow excessive labor demands to ever again take over their lives. Verse 12, observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. They had been liberated from a situation in which work was relentless, and they were to respond by living out that liberty, engaging in regular rest. Then again, they were to respond by abstaining from murder. Verse 17, you shall not murder. They had been liberated from a situation in which life was cheap. Even the life of young babies was cheap. And they were to respond by living out that liberty, now jealously preserving the sanctity of life. Then again, they were to respond by not constructing any idols. Verse 8, you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. They had been liberated from a situation in which they were surrounded by dumb idols. And they were to respond by living out that liberty, refraining from constructing idols, engaging in imageless worship. And so do you see what I'm saying? Do you see the logical connection then between God's liberating grace and the way in which they were to respond to it? And it's the same, is it not, for us as Christians? We keep God's commands as our grateful response to God's saving grace, yes. But these commands aren't an arbitrary response to God's saving grace. Think about it. By nature, we cannot be faithful husbands and wives. Outwardly, perhaps we can, but inwardly, in our hearts, we cannot be faithful husbands and wives. We're in the grip of sexual immorality. But God has liberated us from that grip. And the seventh commandment, therefore, is simply calling upon us to live out that liberty. Then again, by nature, we cannot consistently speak the truth. We cannot consistently be honest and transparent in our speech. We're in the grip of lies and falsehoods. But God has liberated us from that grip. And the ninth commandment, therefore, is simply calling upon us to live out that liberty. Then again, by nature, we cannot resist the temptation to set all our hopes on possessions and wealth and material things. We're in the grip of greed and covetousness. But God has liberated us from that grip. And the tenth commandment, therefore, is simply calling upon us to live out that liberty. Again, you see this logical connection between what God's grace has done for us and how we are to respond to it. And that's why then, the whole idea of a Christian diligently keeping the law of God isn't a demeaning concept. It doesn't somehow detract from the freedom which God has secured for us at the cross of Calvary. No, this is the freedom which God has secured for us. He has made us free to live these kinds of lives. You are never more free than when you are living the kind of life that is set out here in Deuteronomy chapter 5. Third general remark. In an important sense, the Ten Commandments are in themselves the law of God. In an important sense, the Ten Commandments are in themselves the law of God. Now, in previous sermons talking about the structure of Deuteronomy, I've said that the law section kind of runs from chapter 4 all the way to chapter 26. Now, the Ten Commandments are only a very small fraction of that, somewhere in the region of 15 verses here in chapter 5. But I don't think that actually gives a fair picture of the true situation, because in reality, all Moses is doing from chapter 6 onwards is really just applying the Ten Commandments which he has outlined in chapter 5. In fact, I think it's arguable, and we're going to proceed on this basis, that Moses even follows the very order of the Ten Commandments as he applies them in detail to Israel's daily life. And so I'm saying then that the law section of Deuteronomy runs from chapter 4 to chapter 26, yes, but the law proper is here in chapter 5. The Ten Commandments are in themselves the law of God. And everything that comes in the ensuing chapters is just applying those Ten Commandments to Israel's daily lives. And for that reason, then, I'm not going to take forever going through the Ten Commandments here in chapter 5. I'm not going to devote a sermon to each commandment and kind of bring out every possible application that you could ever think of for each one, because that would be to preempt the rest of the book. Moses does the application for us. Of course, it needs to be updated a bit and made relevant to our own situation. But there's no need, I think, to be laborious about going through these Ten Commandments. Well, those are three quite important general remarks then. And in the last few minutes, I'm just going to give a few brief comments on the first three of the Ten Commandments. Commandment number one, then. You shall have no other gods before me. Now, I suppose we might well think that in its original context, in its original setting, the gods that are mentioned here, the false gods that are referred to, are gods in the most straightforward sense. They are religious gods, the supposed deities which the other nations worshipped. We might well think that that striking concept of John Calvin's, that the human heart is a perpetual factory of idols. We might well think that that concept was unknown to Moses and to the Israelites. He wasn't talking about heart idols. He was talking about idols, gods, in the most straightforward religious sense. But I'm not so sure about that. The Ten Commandments, I think, is, apart from anything else, a brilliant piece of literature. It's very beautifully structured, very beautifully ordered. And you'll notice then that the first three commandments have to do with the unique and exclusive lordship of God. That's what the first three are about, aren't they? Having no other gods before him, not making any idols, and not misusing his name. They're about the unique and exclusive lordship of God. And it's interesting then, isn't it, that when the commandments move beyond that, in commandment number 4, it's interesting where they begin. They don't begin then with murder or with adultery. They begin with the Sabbath. That's the next one after those first three about the lordship of God. Why is that? Well, it's reflecting the fact, I think, that one very, very powerful idol, one very, very powerful God is work, labour, economic drive, industry, that kind of thing. And so it's perfectly logical that after those three very explicit commandments about the lordship of God, the next one is about resting from work, because work is this potential god that can easily take over our lives. Then again, why do the Ten Commandments end with the commandment about covetousness? Well, I think the answer probably is that the commandments have come full circle. They're ending where they began. That here again, it's dealing with another powerful god, the god of greed, the god of material things, the god of wealth. Paul certainly linked the two, didn't he? Colossians 3:5, I think it is, where he talks about, he explicitly links idolatry with covetousness, with greed. And I'm saying then that the Ten Commandments themselves recognize, I think, the reality of heart gods. The Ten Commandments themselves point to the reality of a more subtle form of false god than simply the statue, simply the deity of the surrounding nations. They recognize gods like work and covetousness, those kinds of more insidious gods. And of course, anything can fall into that category, can't it? Anything can so easily become a god. Anything that takes the supreme place in our lives. Anything that sits in the driving seat of our thoughts and our agendas and our decision making. Anything that we simply couldn't do without. Whether it be work, whether it be health, whether it be our reputation, whether it be our gift, even. Whether it be something very good and wholesome in and of itself, anything can graduate too high up the ladder in our affections and become a god. And it's very interesting, actually, in the light of what I've just been saying, that the first commandment here recognizes the reality of heart gods. It's very interesting the way that it's phrased, "You shall have no other gods before me," but literally it's, "You shall have no other gods before my face." It's not saying that it's all right to have other gods as long as they're not higher up in your affections than me. That's not the point. It's saying, I think it's helpfully brought out when we think of that modern phrase, "in your face." So if a man dumps his girlfriend and then immediately starts going out with another girl and then starts parading his new girlfriend in front of his former one, we'd say, well, that's a bit in your face. And I think that's the idea here, that even though these gods are often very hidden and very subtle and very lodged deep down in our hearts, so others might not be aware of them, to God, they're in his face. To God, they're audacious and gross and offensive. I think that's the point of that terminology. We find abortion a vile concept, don't we? Surgically intruding into this pregnant woman to wipe out the life that is within her. There's a sense in which, at a metaphorical level, we need to be constantly about the work of abortion, because we have lives developing within us, lives of their own, affections and desires, which are too big and they're taking over and they're in the driving seat. And we need to intrude within our hearts sometimes and abort those gods that are taking over. We need to kill them, we need to slay them. We need to wipe them out. It might seem a distasteful analogy, but surely we're meant to take this seriously. It's the first commandment. If you'd come here this morning and you discovered that I'd already been here for a few hours, and I'd been here with a toolkit, and I'd been erecting a huge idol just somewhere on the platform up here, I'd be unlikely to succeed with my DIY skills, but imagine that that's what I'd been doing. Then you'd be outraged, wouldn't you, coming here this morning? I don't suppose I'd keep my job very long. And yet, we're so much less outraged by the gods that we erect within our own hearts. And we've got to take this seriously. You shall have no other gods that are in my face. Get rid of them all. That's the first commandment. Second commandment, you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. And we've talked about this a bit already, haven't we, in connection with chapter 4. And we've said what's in mind here, what is intended by this prohibition. And it's the practice then, which would have been a great temptation for the Israelites, of making some image, some physical object, not to worship instead of Jehovah, but to use in the worship of Jehovah, to kind of focus and channel their worship of Yahweh. And we said then that the horror of this, the reason why it was so wrong, was because it distorted the nature of God. And in particular, it distorted the fact that God is a speaking God. He's a God who talks. No idol can possibly give that impression of God, because an idol, by definition, can't talk. And so it was a gross distortion of the living, speaking God when you tried to worship him via a dumb idol. And as we kind of implied that morning then, when we were discussing that, there's a sense in which us coming here on a Sunday morning, hungry to hear the Word of God, us coming wanting to get our Bibles open and listen to what God has to say to us from his living Word, there's a sense in which that is the best way of keeping the second commandment. Because that is expressing then our belief in a speaking God. A God who can't possibly be represented by physical objects, because he's a God who talks, a God who instructs, a God who exhorts. He's that kind of God. But of course, we must remember that there are other ways of distorting the nature of God than making a physical idol. We can easily have wrong views, can't we, of what God is like. We can easily slip into thinking of God as just this chummy friend of ours in the skies, reducing his holiness, reducing his grandeur, reducing his transcendence. He's just this little prop, this little crutch that we lean on as we go through life. And that then is distorting the nature of God. Then again, we can easily think of God as harsh and unloving and unsympathetic. A God who delights in our suffering. A God who delights in imposing misery upon us. And we reduce then the mercy and the compassion and the love which the Bible so insists upon when it comes to the nature of God. And again, we're distorting his nature. And there's a sense then in which we, in those instances, are doing what is being prohibited here in the second commandment. We're not making a physical object, but we're worshipping God, the true God, via a wholly inadequate representation of him. A representation that we have come up with, which doesn't resemble the biblical picture of God. We must make sure that the God we have in our minds is the God who is revealed in the Bible. And God takes this seriously, doesn't he? Look at what he says. I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. I think the idea here is probably that where false and distorted views of God are indulged in, then in a context of close family networks, that would inevitably have a result upon the next generation, and then the generation after that, and the generation after that, that they would also have a wrong and false view of God. And in that generational process, God would be expressing his punishment. But equally, when the Israelites had a right view of God, that too would often be passed on from generation to generation, and that equally was God expressing his love. God takes seriously this business. We must have a right view of him. And then the third commandment, you shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God. For the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. The name here then being Yahweh, Jehovah, the God of Israel. And I think when you look at the Bible's testimony as a whole, you can see at least three ways in which it was possible to misuse God's name. First of all, by superstition. So the idea then that simply invoking the name of Jehovah would affect some powerful thing in the spiritual realm. That if you wanted to do something, then you just use the name of Yahweh and it was like a magical spell. And it didn't matter then what you thought of Yahweh. It didn't matter whether you were in a close relationship with him. It didn't matter whether you were engaging with him in your heart and in your mind. Just using his name as a word was like a magical incantation. And that was then one way of misusing his name. And still today we must be careful of just kind of using God's name in a superstitious manner. As if, for instance, saying grace before a meal has some kind of magical significance and value, whether or not we're really engaging in our hearts and minds and really being thankful for the food that he has provided. When we were in Scotland, often a phrase that would be used would be, ask a blessing on the food. And I think it's dangerous, that kind of language, as if there's something just about uttering the words which makes the food kind of holy and dedicated and consecrated. Of course, it's good to thank God for our food, but we shouldn't just be uttering words, we should be meaning it in our hearts. There's no value in the words when our minds and hearts are disengaged. We mustn't misuse his name in a superstitious manner. And again, a second way in which God's name could be misused was in false prophecy. So this was a constant problem, wasn't it, throughout the Old Testament, that you had false prophets coming to Israel and saying, thus says the Lord, I'm coming in the Lord's name, and this is his message. Don't worry about anything. You're fine. Peace, peace, peace. The temple will keep you secure. God's promises will keep you secure. You'll never go into exile. Don't worry about a thing. Just carry on living as you are. Everything's fine. This kind of false prophecy was a recurring problem for Israel. People coming and speaking in the name of the Lord when God hadn't given them that message at all. And again, we can misuse God's name in that way. When, for instance, and I think I touched upon this a little bit last Sunday evening, when we are very confident in ascribing events to God's judgment, when something happens to a city or to a person or to a nation or a society or a civilization, we say, that's God's judgment because of this particular sin. We have to be very careful with that we're saying something in God's name. We're saying, this is definitely the truth. I'm a Christian, I know this is what God is saying. When in fact, God may well not be saying that at all. Or then again, when we're dogmatically insistent about some detail which God's word isn't dogmatically insistent about. Or you can't be a Christian unless you believe that the earth is this old. It's been around for this many years. And again, we're saying these dogmatic things in God's name. We must be very careful not to misuse the name of God in that way. And then thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, God's name could be misused by a corrupt lifestyle. You remember how the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 2 and verse 24, this is in the middle of indicting the Jews for their living, and he says this, as it is written, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Now, there's nowhere in the Old Testament where you find those precise words, but he seems to be drawing on a couple of Old Testament passages and kind of putting it in his own idiom. God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. In other words, the Jews bore the name of their God, Jehovah. He was their God. And whenever then they were living, as so often they were, morally worthless lives, morally indistinct lives, then that was blaspheming God's name amongst the watching Gentiles, because they were able to say, well, you claim he's your God and you live like that. And I don't need to elaborate on the implications of that for us, do I? That we too bear the name of God. We say we're Christians. And if therefore we're living lives that are indistinct from other people around us, if we're living lives that are full of lies and of drunkenness and of selfishness, if we're populating evangelical churches that are dividing and fragmenting all the time, then the world can say, well, you're Christians, you, and look at how you're living. God's name being blasphemed and misused in that sense. So those are the first three commandments, which, as I've said, then are concerned with the uniqueness, the exclusiveness of God's lordship. Is that a concern to us? The Lord's Prayer begins, doesn't it? On that note, hallowed be your name. The Ten Commandments begin on this note. And that's because it's the fundamental note of the whole Bible. And it should be the fundamental note of our lives, that God is Lord and we must honour and worship him. Let's make sure that that is the dominant note of our lives today. Amen. We're going to close singing Psalm 72. Now, this is from the appendix in the Red Psalm book, so it's at the back, page 197. And it's the last three verses of Psalm 72. And it speaks of God's name, particularly verse, I draw your attention to verse 19, and blessed be his glorious name to all eternity. So that's the opposite of misusing his name. Praying that his name might be blessed to all eternity. So let's sing these three verses of Psalm 72.